The Contra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Contra AI. Welcome back, everyone. Today, we're diving deep into a really provocative piece of work. It's Samuel Huntington's The Clash of Civilizations and the Remaking of World Order, a book that, frankly, caused quite a stir.
It really did. And it's still incredibly relevant if you want to get a handle on, well, the world today. Think about it. The Cold War ends, the big ideological fight, you know, communism versus capitalism just disappears.
Right. The whole structure's gone.
Exactly. So the big question hanging in the air was, what comes next? What defines global politics now? What are the new fault lines going to be?
And the mood back then, mostly, was super optimistic. Francis Fukuyama's end of history idea was huge. The belief that liberal democracy had basically won.
Yeah, that was the dominant narrative.
But then Huntington comes along with this completely different take. He argued future conflicts wouldn't be about economics or ideology primarily.
Mm-hmm. He said it would be about culture. Deep, fundamental cultural identity.
That's the absolute core of it. He predicted the world would clash along the lines of these huge cultural groups, these civilizations, he called them, defined by things like religion, history, shared values.
It was a radical shift from how people were thinking about global conflict, a total reframing.
Definitely. Now, to really get this book, you need to understand the person behind it, Samuel P. Huntington. He lived from 1927 to 2008, a real heavyweight academic at Harvard for decades.
Yeah, not exactly an unknown figure. He'd already written some major stuff like Political Order and Changing Societies in the Third Wave, about democratization.
Right. But what made Huntington's perspective so unique, I think, was this blend he had. He was deep into political theory, specifically political realism, you know, focusing on power, state interest, conflict.
But he wasn't just an ivory tower academic.
Not at all. He had practical policy experience, too. He consulted for the U.S. government, was even on the National Security Council under Jimmy Carter.
That's a really interesting combination, the big picture theorist, who also understood the nuts and bolts of policy.
Exactly. It allowed him to connect dots maybe others weren't seeing. And he was known for being a bit of a contrarian, you know, always pushing against the conventional wisdom.
Which definitely explains why this whole clash of civilizations idea made such waves. It first appeared as an article in Foreign Affairs in 1993.
Oh, yeah. The reaction was immediate. Outrage, debate. It was everywhere.
He basically looked at everyone celebrating the end of the Cold War and said, hold on, you're missing the real story. The main event is just starting.
And that huge reaction prompted him to flesh out the whole argument into the full book, which came out in 1996.
Okay, so let's unpack this new world map he drew. He says the world isn't just nation states anymore. It's organizing around these civilizations.
Right, the biggest we, the highest level of cultural grouping beyond the nation state. And these are defined by those fundamental things. Religion being a huge one, language, history, customs, values.
And he didn't just talk about it abstractly. He named them. He identified eight major ones for the contemporary world.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if I remember them all. There's Western, obviously North America, Western Europe. Then Cynic, or Confucian, centered on China. Japanese, which he specifically split off from Cynic.
Okay.
Islamic, Hindu, basically India. Slavic Orthodox, centered on Russia, Latin American. And he suggested possibly African as an emerging one.
So this whole framework, it directly challenges that optimistic idea that as countries modernize, they'll just naturally become more like the West.
Absolutely. He flat out called that idea a dangerous illusion.
Why, though? Why wouldn't economic development lead to adopting Western democratic values, for example?
Because of this key concept he introduced, indigenization. It's a powerful idea. He argued that, yes, non-Western societies are modernizing, adopting technology, globalizing their economy.
You see that everywhere.
But at the same time, they're pushing back against Western cultural influence and actually doubling down on their own unique cultures, their languages, their traditions, and critically, their religions.
So, like, they might use Western tech to build a factory.
Exactly.
But the way they run the company, the social interactions, that's all based on their own, say, Confucian or Islamic values.
Precisely. Modernization gives them the tools, think global communication, media, to actually strengthen and project their own distinct identity onto the world stage, not erase it.
Okay, I see.
Think about the Islamic resurgence or the rise of Hindu nationalism or leaders talking about Asian values that emphasize community over Western individualism. Modernization empowers cultural distinctiveness. It doesn't necessarily mean Westernization.
Okay, so if this multi-civilizational world is the new chessboard,
How does the game play out? Huntington starts by pushing back against the harmony idea, right? He looked at early post-Cold War conflicts.
Yeah, like the first Gulf War or the absolute horror show in the Balkans.
And he said, look, these make way more sense if you view them through a civilizational lens rather than old Cold War categories.
Exactly. And he talks about the shifting balance of global power. He acknowledged the West was still dominant militarily and economically back then.
But he saw trends changing.
Definitely. He pointed to demographics, economic growth rates, showing the West's relative decline compared to what he called challenger civilizations.
And who were the main challengers in his view?
Primarily two. The Islamic world, which he noted had this huge youth bulge, lots of young people, which often fuels social and political change, sometimes instability. And second, the Cynic civilization, meaning China, with its absolutely booming economy and growing military power.
Okay, so power is shifting. The world is grouping differently. How does this shape the new international order? He introduces the idea of core states.
Right. These are basically the leaders within each civilization, the big, powerful countries that kind of anchor their cultural bloc, like the U.S. for the West, China for the Cynic world, Russia for the Slavic Orthodox, India for the Hindu civilization, and so on.
And these core states play a crucial role when conflicts break out.
Hugely important. Because of this other key concept, the kin country syndrome, this is really central to his argument about future conflict.
Explain that a bit more.
It means that when a conflict starts, especially between groups from different civilizations, other states will tend to rally not based on old alliances or pure economics, but based on shared civilizational identity. They support their kind.
Okay. And the classic example he uses is the breakup of Yugoslavia in the 1990s.
Exactly. It was a brutal illustration. You had Orthodox Serbs. Who did they get backing from?
Russia, their Orthodox kin state.
Right. Then you had the Catholic Croats, supported by Western European countries, Germany, the Vatican.
Their cultural kin.
Mm-hmm. And the Bosnian Muslims received support, diplomatic and otherwise, from Islamic countries like Iran, Saudi Arabia, Turkey.
So the conflict wasn't just local. It immediately got pulled into these larger civilizational alignments.
Which made it incredibly difficult to resolve. It wasn't just about land. It became about defending fundamental cultural and religious identity. Huntington saw this as a blueprint for how future conflicts could escalate.
He also talked about countries caught in the middle, didn't he? These torn countries.
Yeah, that's another interesting category. Turkey is his prime example.
Right, Turkey.
These are countries where the leadership is actively trying to pull the nation out of its historical civilizational sphere and into another one. In Turkey's case, the post-Ottoman leaders, especially Ataturk, made a huge push to secularize and westernize the country.
Adopting Western laws, script, dress codes.
Exactly. But Huntington argues this creates deep divisions within the society. Part of the country wants to be Western. Part feels strongly tied to its Islamic roots and history. It's a constant internal struggle over identity.
And that struggle is really hard to resolve cleanly.
Extremely hard. Mexico and Russia were other examples he discussed, wrestling with their relationship to the West versus their own distinct identities.
So if these civilizational blocs are the main actors, where do they actually, well, clash?
Along the fault lines. That's his term for the actual borders, the geographic boundaries, where different civilizations meet.
Okay.
Fault line conflicts are those wars and clashes that happen right there between groups from different civilizations living next to each other. Think about places like the Balkans, the Caucasus, Kashmir.
And why are these conflicts often so nasty and long-lasting?
Because, again, they're usually not just about resources or territory, though that can be part of it. They're fundamentally about identity, about religion, about us versus them at the deepest cultural level. These things are much harder to compromise on than, say, adjusting a border or a trade tariff.
Right. Like the India-Pakistan conflict, rooted in the Hindu-Muslim civilizational divide. Or conflicts in the Caucasus between Christian Armenians and Muslim Azeris, for example.
Precisely. And then, zooming out from the local fault lines, he saw a bigger macro-level tension emerging, the West versus the rest. He argued that the era of Western dominance was creating a pushback, and he specifically highlighted what he called the Cynic-Islamic connection.
Okay, that sounds provocative. What did he mean by that?
He suggested there was a kind of strategic alignment, sometimes quiet, sometimes more open, between China and various Islamic states. not based on shared values, obviously, but on a shared interest in counterbalancing Western power and influence.
How would they do that?
Through cooperation on things like military technology, trade, diplomatic support, and international forums, basically, working together to resist Western pressure and assert their own models. This was a really controversial claim in the 90s.
I can imagine. So, given this potentially dangerous New World Order, did Huntington offer any solutions? How do we avoid constant clashes?
He did offer some prescriptions,
yeah.
But they weren't necessarily comforting to Western ears. His main warning was for the West to abandon universalism, meaning the belief that Western values, democracy, individualism, human rights, as defined by the West, are universal and should be promoted or even imposed everywhere.
He saw that as counterproductive.
Worse than counterproductive. He saw it as cultural arrogance, almost imperialism, that would inevitably provoke intense backlash and resentment from other civilizations.
So if the West shouldn't try to remake the world in its image, what should it do? How do you maintain stability?
He proposed two main rules, kind of principles for managing this multi-civilizational world. First, the abstaining rule.
Abstain from what?
Core states should abstain from intervening in conflicts happening with another civilizations. Basically, respect spheres of influence, let other civilizations sort out their internal issues.
That sounds difficult, especially for a superpower like the U.S. that often feels compelled to intervene.
Absolutely. It's a call for restraint. The second rule was the joint mediation rule. This says that when conflicts erupt along those dangerous fault lines between civilizations, the core states of the involved civilizations need to work together to contain and mediate the conflict.
So cooperation between the major powers is key for managing those inter-civilizational clashes.
Exactly. It requires a degree of mutual respect, recognizing the legitimacy of other civilizational centers, and working multilaterally instead of unilaterally. It's about managing diversity, not trying to eliminate it.
Okay, if we were to boil this whole complex argument down, what are the absolute key takeaways for you, the big messages someone should remember?
All right, three big ones stand out for me. First, culture trumps all. Ultimately, he argues, cultural identity, shared religion, history, values is the most fundamental force driving how people align and where the major conflicts will arise, more so than economics or political ideology in this new era.
Okay, culture first. What's number two?
The decline of universalism. Or maybe the illusion of universalism, the Western idea that its values are inherently global and destined to be adopted everywhere. Huntington says that's a dangerous fantasy. Trying to force it just breeds resentment and resistance.
So a call for Western humility in a way.
You could say that. And number three, which really flew in the face of a lot of theories at the time, the resurgence of religion. Modernization, he argued, does not automatically lead to secularization, to religion fading away.
Right. Many thought it would.
But look around. The Islamic resurgence, the rise of Hindu nationalism in India, the revival of the Orthodox Church in Russia. Religion is proving to be an incredibly powerful, enduring, and often transnational force shaping global politics.
Yeah, that really resonates. It helps make sense of why, for instance, just opening up markets in a place like China doesn't automatically create a Western-style democracy.
Exactly. Or why you see such deep disagreements in international organizations over basic things like human rights or governance. Different civilizational backgrounds lead to fundamentally different priorities and worldviews.
The book is definitely known for some memorable, even blunt quotes.
Oh, yeah. He didn't mince words. You already mentioned the core thesis statement itself, which is worth repeating. The fundamental source of conflict in this new world will not be primarily ideological or primarily economic. The great divisions among humankind will be cultural. That just sets the whole stage.
It really does. What else stands out?
There's one that really forces you to confront the history of Western power, he wrote. The West won the world not by the superiority of its ideas or values or religion, but rather by its superiority in applying organized violence. Westerners often forget this fact. Non-Westerners never do.
Wow. That's stark.
Yeah.
It completely challenges the narrative of winning through moral or ideological superiority.
It's a reminder that power, often brutal power, played a huge role, and that history shapes how the rest of the world perceives the West today.
Definitely makes you think. Any others?
Well, there's his prediction about the main sources of future tension, written back in the mid-90s, he said. The dangerous clashes of the future are likely to arise from the interaction of Western arrogance, Islamic intolerance, and cynic assertiveness.
And that's quite a prediction. Western arrogance, Islamic intolerance, cynic assertiveness.
Yeah, it captures the specific dynamics he saw brewing between these major civilizational forces. Whether you agree with his labels or not, it's certainly highlighted key areas of friction we've continued to see.
So let's bring this down to earth. How can someone listening apply these ideas? What are the real-world applications?
Well, on the foreign policy level, if you're involved in that world, it suggests a need for much greater cultural awareness, maybe less emphasis on exporting democracy wholesale, and more focus on culturally sensitive diplomacy, understanding different civilizational perspectives, and promoting stability through balance rather than intervention.
Respecting differences rather than trying to erase them.
Pretty much. And for business and marketing, it's hugely relevant. If you're a global company, you absolutely cannot assume a Western model works everywhere. You need to understand how different cultures approach contracts, hierarchy, finance.
Right. You mentioned Islamic finance earlier. Totally different rules based on religious principles.
Exactly. Ignoring those civilizational norms is a recipe for failure. You need deep cultural intelligence.
And what about just for us as individuals? Personal competence.
I think the framework is incredibly useful just for navigating our increasingly diverse world. Recognizing that someone's civilizational background, their deep cultural programming, essentially shapes how they see the world, what they value, how they communicate.
It helps you understand why people might react differently.
Yes, it fosters empathy, or at least understanding. It can make you a better negotiator, a better leader, a better colleague, even just a better neighbor in a multicultural society. It enhances your ability to connect across differences.
For me, the big takeaway, the lasting value, is that it forces us to accept complexity. The world isn't converging into one single model. It's pluralistic. And managing that pluralism requires cultural competence and maybe a dose of humility, rather than assuming our way is the only way.
I agree. And what really surprised me, revisiting the book, was Huntington's conclusion. After outlining all these external clashes and challenges, especially for the West, he argues that the biggest threat to the West isn't actually from China or the Islamic world. It's internal. It's the potential decay of its own culture, its own values, its own identity.
So the solution isn't imposing Western values elsewhere.
No. He concludes the West needs its own cultural renewal. It needs to reaffirm and strengthen its own unique civilization, rather than trying to make the whole world Western. That call for self-reflection looking inward was really powerful.
That is a powerful thought. Maybe the focus shouldn't always be outward, but inward first. A challenge from within. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.